Hello, and welcome to Evil in the Stacks, a short-run podcast dedicated to exploring the University of Pittsburgh's horror comics archival collection. I'm Genevieve Newman, a PhD candidate at Pitt, working this year with Archives and Special Collections to put our comics holdings into conversation with our horror studies holdings. Today's episode, Comics Horror Across Mediums, will cover the intersections between comics and other mediums in the horror genre, so film, television, games, etc., with expert Dr. Adam Hart, whose work focuses on formal analysis, transmediality, and the horror genre. He's also done extensive work as an archivist and scholar with the George A. Romero Collection here at Pitt. So we'll also be talking about that as well. And the interview ran a bit long this time, so there won't be an intro section. I just didn't want to cut the conversation, as it really was a lot of fun, and it's a super interesting deep dive into the genre and kind of a formal analysis of what the genre means and does. And don't worry, you'll hear in a second. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. All right, so I am here with Dr. Adam Hart, who I'm going to let introduce himself, but I just wanted to open with kind of an intro of why I really wanted to get this interview with him in particular, because one of the texts that's been most useful to me throughout my career trajectory in the last maybe couple of years has been his Monstrous Forms, which deals a lot with horror media kind of across mediums and not looking at them as wholly distinct, but really kind of making sense of them as connected. And that's been really vital for my own work and my own understanding of the genre. So fangirling aside, I am going to let him do a more substantial introduction of where he's at now and what's kind of going on with him, and then we'll jump into the interview. So, Adam, go ahead.
Sure. So, I'm Adam Hart. I'm a scholar and archivist. I have one monograph out already, Monstrous Forms, Moving Image Horror Across Media, that looks at the way that style and ideas travel from one kind of horror medium to another, from films to games to TV, and mixing and matching, but also looking at the ways in which each time it sort of finds an idea, finds a new home, it becomes distinct and unique to that platform, to that medium. I have another book coming out next year called Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. I was, along with Ben Rubin, one of the people who processed George Romero's archives. And this book looks at, sort of reevaluates George Romero's career and his body of work based on the just incredible volume of writing that he did that never made it to the screen. Reevaluating both his place in the horror genre, but also the way that we think about sort of the labor of filmmaking, for such an expensive medium, it's so difficult to get a feature film all the way to the finish line. So why is it, the book sort of provocatively asked, that we let a handful of studio executives and financiers decide how we think of the shape of a filmmaker's career, rather than looking at the stuff they spent their time, their creative energy, their passion doing. I also have another book coming out next year. All these are from Oxford University Press, but are hopefully accessible to more than just the academic audience, about the history and theory and politics of the handheld camera called The Living Camera. And that's where I've been kind of immersed lately, finishing that up. So that's what I've been doing.
Amazing. With all of that aside, let's kind of jump in with an idea of what the term transmedia means, or where it comes from, or any kind of like context around this idea.
Right. So the idea with transmedia, the reason why it was coined is to sort of distinguish certain kinds of franchises or, you know, multi-work storytelling from adaptations. So the idea with an adaptation is that there is a book or a TV show or a game or something, and then somebody adapts that into another medium, but there is very clearly and distinctly an original for it, right? So the idea with transmedia is that you can't really say there's an original anymore. That maybe there's a first thing, but is Star Trek as a franchise movies or TV, or I'm assuming there's games, or there's comic books, there's novels and novelizations. You can't really say that one thing is Star Trek. You know, the Star Trek movies are not an adaptation of the TV show. It's a continuation. It's a storytelling mode that crosses all of these different mediums, and the word adaptation doesn't fit anymore. So that's kind of why it's coined. In the 90s, you also start to see the Wachowskis and other storytellers, artists, filmmakers, etc., starting to tell their stories across mediums. So it's not just that, like, you know, with Star Trek, that there's another Next Generation's movie and a new TV show and something like that that are part of the same overall universe, but in some way distinct. But if you want to know the backstory for certain characters in The Matrix, you have to play a video game or read comic books or something along those lines. That's something that's kind of become so ingrained in the culture now that it's almost like the phrase is almost not used anymore, because it's just sort of expected that for certain kinds of franchises, there will be some expectation that you've seen something else or played or read something else, at the same time that if they're trying to be a billion-dollar movie, they try to make it distinct. But regardless, that's why transmedia as a term was coined, and the ways that people have approached the idea in the past few decades. But it is relatively recent, like we were talking about earlier. It's certainly not a new phenomenon. It required the sort of easy access to media that we start seeing in the early days of the internet, but also just, you know, with the spread of, like, video stores and, you know, video games that you could rent and TV on video and that sort of thing, in order for it to become kind of wider, in order for creators to kind of expect that there's a possibility that a viewer or gamer or reader could encounter or could seek out another instantiation of the story.
Right. So transmedia storytelling doesn't really happen without something like Blockbuster. Is kind of the idea. Something like, maybe not that brand, but without the video rental that also does games, that also does, right? We don't, at TV, we don't really get this phenomenon that I'm hearing you talk about, where the narrative is to some degree incomplete if you only interact with one piece of media, yeah, or one medium in which the story is told.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So along those lines, in terms of kind of getting to the question of comic books, there are two trends that I've seen in our collection. So there's the straight adaptation. There's so much Poe, and there's some Shakespeare, and there's, I mean, even beyond Classics Illustrated, which is a title that specifically does literary adaptation. We also see, like, Creepy magazine has so many different versions of Edgar Allan Poe stories. It is actually mind-boggling. So that's where we would put adaptation, I think, right? As a distinct thing from
transmedia. And then, you know, turnabout being that, especially recently, there have been a bunch of high-profile adaptations of comic books, like
right.
Sweet Tooth or Lock and Key.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's like no sense in which you have to, you know, like they are straight adaptations. They're not continuations of the story. Those are comic series that are complete, and that if the creators go back to them at any point, it will be sort of a revisitation of like of a already finished story.
Right. So then the other thing we see is a lot of TV tie-ins. So it's interesting you would mention Star Trek in particular, because as I was going through and indexing some of our other titles, I ran across a huge run of Star Trek comics. But we have similar stuff happening with horror titles. The kind of interesting thing with that, though, is when we get into horror comics as they intersect with moving images, we see things like Romero's adaptation, or not even adaptation, but kind of inspiration through comic books in Creepshow or something like that. So I'm wondering if you, especially as someone who's worked with Romero's archive, have any thoughts on like why might the comic books have been so influential?
First of all, like the influence of those old Tales from the Crypt style horror comics from the 50s was something that people noticed right away as part of like the DNA for Night of the Living Dead. Like these sort of, there's a couple of waves of reviews. The first one, you know, was the sort of pearl-clutching mainstream critics who were reaching for their fainting couches as they watched Night of the Living Dead. But then like the younger, hipper critics for like the Village Voice and, you know, some of the film magazines start to catch on. And they immediately see what Romero is doing, which is he's making a moving image version of a EC comic, of a Tales from the Crypt style horror comic, but one that has different kinds of resonances, because when you translate it to a new medium, it does something different. And so I think that the reason that it's so influential for Romero is that he was a kid in the 1950s. You know, this is an inspiration. It's not a straight adaptation, but it's one that was formative for him. Like these are things that he was reading when he was 10 years old, and that sort of formed his conception of horror as a genre. That and, you know, sort of like rubber costume monster movies from the 50s. And for everything else that Night of the Living Dead is, it's kind of a science fiction rubber costume monster movie from the 50s, just kind of couldn't afford or didn't want to do a rubber costume. So they just put some like white makeup on people instead. And, you know, that's those sort of formative influences just come up throughout Romero's filmography, whether they're horror related or not. You see the stuff that he was encountering early in his life, early in his sort of like teenage, early 20s cinephilia, just reappearing over and over again as sometimes very direct or explicit inspirations.
Okay, so that kind of gets us to this or some kind of answer to the question of why comics. This is something that I get a lot whenever I talk about this podcast or the archives or anything like that, is like, but why do we care about comic books? So then I would like you to take a stab, if you will, at the question of why horror, right? This is kind of a maligned genre. So what do you think the horror genre has to tell us? I mean, because you're describing this process of kind of osmosis, right? For filmmakers picking up different pieces stylistically or narratively from different mediums that they've encountered in their life. So then the question is, if we're talking about like what horror kind of does in the world in the same way, like comic books obviously can influence creative output. They do many other things as well, but that is one answer, right? So do you have an idea of an answer for the horror genre?
I'm attracted to horror because I'm attracted to the way that it subverts and undoes sort of the polite hierarchies of art. It shows things that other genres don't show or aren't supposed to show. It talks about things that we aren't supposed to talk about in polite company. And it does it in a way that is sometimes completely unacceptable. It's too sensational, too bloody, too bodily, both in the sense of like how much it shows, but also in how much it engages with the viewer, the reader, the gamer. You know, like the polite great work of art is supposed to stimulate your brain and your sort of unembodied sense of aesthetic refinement and appreciation, whereas the horror movie makes you jump and scream and maybe feel a little sick to your stomach. And there's just this sort of accepted hierarchy that one is better than the other. And I'd like that horror subverts that.
Right. So it's kind of obliterating this holdover idea of the mind-body split.
Yeah.
Right. So this is something we get in philosophy is the idea, the phrase that everyone knows is I think, therefore I am. Right. So that the idea that like you are defined by thought, not by body or not by embodiment.
Right.
So then what do we do with, and I hate the phrase, but elevated horror, or as I prefer, art horror. Like, what do we do with this kind of subgenre that is straddling the line between embodiment and kind of a loftier agenda, if you will?
I mean, I think there's room for plenty of different kinds of horror. There's room for what's an elevated horror?
Midsummer. I was talking about Midsummer last night, and that's why it's on my mind.
Right. So there's room for Midsummer, as well as you know, some sort of like down and dirty movie like The Terrifier 2. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of those A24 movies that I like quite a bit. I really do like Midsummer. But I also think that the further away you get from that sort of subversive charge of horror, the less interested I am, I guess. The less I have to latch onto for understanding why you're using the horror genre. You know, the like Midsummer is a very compelling movie. It's a really, you know, there's a great lead performance. It's really fascinating. Start to finish, it has a lot in common with horror movies, but really there's only a couple of moments where it sort of indulges in sort of horror-ish spectacle. You know, I'm thinking of the old people, the like smashing.
Yeah. Or the way that the corpses are kind of laid out and spectacularized, right?
Yeah. It's a film that wants to disorient you, but not necessarily like hit you in the gut, with a couple of exceptions. And like, to me, it feels like those are exceptions rather than you know, part of like an aesthetic or I don't know, sort of like philosophical subversion. Mm-hmm. It's polite. It's something that I can show my mom. She can look away in that one scene and she could still get it. And there's room for that. But I do think that horror needs to sort of, as a genre, remember what it does really well and what it can do that no other genre can do.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I've come to different answers with different people on this, but I think that really takes into account the like aesthetic and formal qualities, as opposed to just being straight narrative analysis, right? And I think that especially since the podcast is on comics, and that's a very like heavy aesthetic form, right? I think that that's a fantastic answer for this particular kind of context, right? I wanted to see if you had any thoughts on like comic books as a medium utilizing horror, if you have any thoughts on like what they do differently, if you can put that into conversation with film or television or video games or something like that. But I'm really interested, since you are so astute with formal analysis, like if you have any thoughts there on this medium or even graphic novel, which is sometimes the same, sometimes not, but like thoughts in that realm. And the examples don't have to be from like the 60s to the 80s.
I don't know how much on this podcast you've spoken with like comics historians, but you know, the thing to like the place that you have to start for horror comics is that they were banned, that they caused a sort of hysteria among, you know, the polite mainstream middle of the road types in the 1950s. And what bothered people so much about them was that they were perverting the children, right? That children would read these and instantly turn into like slavering maniacs who were, you know, killers and criminals and perverts, and just it would ruin an entire generation. You know, there's no evidence, there's never been any evidence that that's the case, of course. But that didn't stop the crusade against comics in the 1950s that sort of did away with horror as a genre in the comics industry. It was no longer possible to sell comics on newsstands if they had sort of gross spectacles in them. Now you look at those old comics and what in the hearings and the sort of widespread denunciations of them, you know, there were book burnings and stuff. In those, you would see panels taken out of gross things, of a, you know, the famous one is the like playing baseball with the decapitated heads and all of that. The thing is, like, these are very cartoony. Like, it's very obvious that they are not aspiring towards realism. They're not even necessarily trying to scare people. There's something kind of fundamentally jokey about those old comics that Romero picked up on and sort of made the foundation for Creepshow. And, like, that jokiness has sort of defined our understanding of those old horror comics, thanks in large part to Romero, who, you know, after Creepshow, you know, Robert Zemeckis and others do Tales from the Crypt, which picks up on like precisely that tone, that approach to the old horror comics, that these are fun and jokey. But that idea, that drawing of the decapitated head or the body that's come back to life or the monster as being an image that kids in particular would not be able to get out of their brains, that it would just be stuck there and it would traumatize them, and that it would cause them to, you know, become criminals and all of that. It's sort of at the basis of the horror genre in comics. You see a slight resurgence a couple of decades later in the 1970s when superhero comics start incorporating horror themes. But it's really not until like the 90s, 2000s that horror becomes like a really powerful genre on its own in comics. I think that there's just like, it's maybe the most like exciting horror medium, like at the moment. Like there's just so much really phenomenal stuff being put out by just a really wide variety of creators, you know, from this kind of like introspective, autobiographical-ish fantasy like Emil Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters, you know, which is itself one of my favorite things, to more visceral in every sense sort of works like Ed Piskor's stuff, to just like really creative, imaginative storytelling from, you know, Joe Hill, like Lock and Key, but also, a few other series that he's done, like Jeff Lemire, who did Sweet Tooth, like Harrow County, which I know you're a big fan of and which I love quite a bit. They're all everything that I just mentioned, all those creators are sort of interested in the thin line between fantasy and reality that comics are in a lot of ways uniquely suited for. If you're looking at like a film or TV show, you can obviously explore that in, you know, a variety of different ways, but the photographic image, just there's something real about it. If you're talking about literature, there's a million ways to explore that line, but everything is in some sense imagination. You are conjuring the images, you're, you know, reading and processing the story yourself. But the sort of balance between drawn images and the literary, you know, verbal or not verbal, but the literary aspect of the storytelling, it finds this middle ground where it has some foot in reality, but is free to, you know, venture off at any point into fantasy. And the way that recent comics creators have been employing that to work through fantastic worlds, fantastic beings, while, you know, kind of rooted in something very personal and intimate and that feels very true to me, is just extremely exciting. There's no book in my entire lifetime that I've been more excited for than My Favorite Thing is Monsters Volume 2, which has been coming soon for 6 years at this point. And, Emil Ferris can take as much time as she wants to do it. I will be there on opening day. I'll line up at midnight at Barnes & Noble or whatever people used to do for the Harry Potter books. And I'll be the only one, but I'll get it first.
Yes. It's just to jump back a little bit, it's interesting because in the first episode, if people want to go back and listen if they missed it or whatever, I did talk a little bit about Wortham and Seduction of the Innocent and the Comics Code Authority. And the way you're contextualizing it puts it kind of in conversation, I think, really well with the moral panic around violent video games.
Yeah.
Which is not so much grounded in horror as it is just in the medium itself, because I mean, violent video games as a term can encompass first-person shooters and action games, and right.
The franchise that made people the craziest. Well, I guess there's a couple different places, but like it was, in one decade it was Mortal Kombat, like a fighting game, and then in the next it was Grand Theft Auto.
Right.
And yet, I don't know. Horror always seems to bear the brunt of those sorts of efforts.
Right. So the conversation that's happening is about a broader spectrum of things. Because along those lines, in Seduction of the Innocent, there are two titles from Classics Illustrated that are cited. One is distinctively a horror title. The other is Uncle Tom's Cabin, though. Okay. Right. And along similar lines, like if we're talking about violence in comics, a lot of those classics illustrated, a lot of the early EC stuff that's meant to be like histories of the US is incredibly violent before we even get to the extreme racism that is made visual and like visceral in a certain way. So it's interesting to me thinking about how horror, like you said, it bears the brunt of this stuff, even though the problem people have is with the moral panic itself kind of comes about around the medium, mm-hmm. not the genre.
Right.
Do you have any other thoughts on that? Or,
well, I mean, I think that that's tied to the sort of just transgressive, subversive nature of horror in general. You know, like Wortham can complain about perceived homoeroticism in superhero comics, but that's not going to get legislated away. Because in some sense, like, you know, however outlandish his arguments and his evidence, and however many sort of false assumptions or, you know, just like offensive assumptions he has to make to, you know, denounce Batman or Superman or whatever, Batman and Superman are the mainstream. They uphold the sort of dominant values and conventions of society, whereas horror is a challenge. And it's that challenge that makes it extra dangerous.
And I think on that note, I am going to wrap us up. Is there anything that you'd like to kind of plug or advertise that you've got out at the moment? And I can always drop links in the show notes.
Well, I mean, I can just say, you know, like the book, it's been out for a couple of years now, but it, you know, dropped at the start of the pandemic. So it sort of feels like you just, you know, put several years of your life into a bottle and send it out into the sea when everybody else is, you know, trying to swim for their own lives at the moment.
Right.
You know, that's a bit more sort of theoretical, but is hopefully accessible. The Romero book should be out early next year from Oxford University Press. And that is written so that anybody who's interested in Romero, anybody who's interested in horror can pick it up. You know, you do have to be interested in Romero, I think, because I get pretty in-depth into his life and career and the various works. It's not like a theoretical academic jargony kind of thing. So that should be out early 2024.
Okay. And there was an article you mentioned earlier that I think people would be really excited about.
Oh, yeah. So the next issue of The Moving Image, which is the journal, the Association of Moving Image Archivists, should be out soon. You know, academic publishing calendars,
yes.
Who knows
what
it is. But I wrote an article about the Romero Archive and specifically about Jacaranda Joe, the lost Romero film that Ben and I found, and that, you know, I was able to track down the original 35mm negatives and another cut of the film. You know, that is not something that you will find on newsstands, but libraries, particularly university libraries, should have it. And there should be some way to read it online soon, as soon as it drops. But you will notice it because there is a Bigfoot on the cover from Jacaranda Joe, the skunk ape from the Florida swamps. That's the subject of Romero's short film that he made in the early 90s with a bunch of college kids at Valencia Community College. And I'm extremely thrilled to see that cover more than seeing, you know, the article itself, maybe.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much. And once again, I'm going to also plug Monstrous Forms because I think everyone should read it. And it's amazing. And it is very accessibly written. So keep an eye out for new stuff, but also go ahead and go pick up a new or a copy of Monstrous Forms. And thank you with that for coming on today, taking time out of your very, very busy writing schedule. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. This was a blast.